Okay, so Acts chapter 12. This is the last in the series on Acts. And then next week we're going into God's Not Dead. And that's not so much because we were in any great doubt that he might be, but really just an affirmation in the context of a society and a culture which is profoundly sceptical, that at its best asks lots of questions, but actually at its worst simply assumes that God is past history, that none of this is relevant, that it's all a bygone superstition. How to present our faith in a way that makes sense and holds water in a context like that. So we're going to be spending about 6 weeks doing that. It is primarily to equip us as Christians so that we're not sort of going into situations thinking, I've not a clue what to say, I've not a clue how to answer questions that people chuck at me and so on. But if you know folks who aren't Christians who are asking those questions and can cope with Woody, it might be okay for them as well. So there's just a thought. I'm going to read Acts chapter 12, verses 1 to 19. It was about this time that King Herod... I'm going to get rid of that, if I may, because I like to wander about a bit. It was about this time that King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute them. He had James, the brother of John, put to death with the sword. When he saw that this pleased the Jews, he proceeded to seize Peter also. This happened during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. After arresting him, he put him in prison, handing him over to be guarded by four squads of four soldiers each. Herod intended to bring him out for public trial after the Passover. And so Peter was kept in prison, but the church was earnestly praying to God for him. The night before Herod was to bring him out for trial, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and sentries stood guard at the entrance. Suddenly, an angel of the Lord appeared, and a light shone in the cell. He struck Peter on the side and woke him up. "Quick, get up," he said. And the chains fell off Peter's wrists. Then the angel said to him, "Put on your clothes and your sandals." And Peter did so. "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me," the angel told him. Peter followed him out of the prison, but he had no idea that what the angel was doing was really happening. He thought he was seeing a vision. They passed the first and the second guards and came to the iron gate leading to the city, which opened for them by itself. And they went through it. When they walked the length of one street, suddenly the angel left him. Then Peter came to himself and he said, "Now I know without a doubt that the Lord sent his angel and rescued me from Herod's clutches and from everything the Jewish people were anticipating." When this had dawned on him, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, also called Mark, where many people had gathered and were praying. Peter knocked at the outer entrance, and a servant girl called Rhoda came to answer the door. When she recognized Peter's voice, she was so overjoyed, she ran back without opening it and exclaimed, "Peter's at the door!" "You're crazy," they told her. When she kept insisting that it was so, they said, "Must be his angel." But Peter kept on knocking, and when they opened the door and saw him, they were astonished. Peter motioned with his hand for them to be quiet and described how the Lord had brought him out of prison. "Tell James and the brothers about this," he said. And then he left for another place. In the morning, there was no small commotion among the soldiers as to what had become of Peter. After Herod had a thorough search made for him and did not find him, he cross-examined the guards and ordered that they be executed. Well, on the face of it, this is the story of an amazing prison breakout. James, one of the 12 apostles, has been arrested and executed by one of quite several Roman puppet kings called Herod. They all seem to like to call themselves Herod, and this was one of them. It is a move that appeals to the sort of mob, part of the mob. It's a populist sort of move. And so Herod, noting that it goes down well, decides that Peter's turn comes next. Peter is slung into prison with a view to another high-profile public killing. And it is the night before the public trial, the public show trial. The guard is pretty draconian for someone who is actually no more than a fisherman turned preacher. There are no less than 16 professional soldiers who are detailed to guard him in shifts, four at a time. At any given moment, Peter is chained to a soldier on each side of him, and then there are two more who are guarding the door of his cell. This would be over the top, even if it was the Cray brothers or the Mad Axe murderer, but actually this is just a preacher. It is a ludicrous level of hypersecurity. And it is remarkable that with the trial the next day and soldiers beside him and chains cutting into his flesh, that Peter manages to sleep, but he does. And suddenly as he sleeps, he's awoken by a light in his cell and he feels a tap on his side. He looks up and he sees a man who says, "Quick, get up." Chains fall off his wrists. The soldiers are apparently asleep or drugged or something like that all through this. He grabs his coat and his shoes. He follows this unknown man past the open door of his cell. Two more soldiers should have been guarding. And then he's led out of the main gate of the prison. All this time he's in a daze. He half thinks that he's having a dream. I'm imagining this. But as the gate opens in front of him, he feels the cold blast of the night air in his face. And they walk down the street together. Then suddenly, he's on his own. The man has disappeared. And it is at this stage that Peter realizes that this is no dream. A miracle has taken place and he's now a free man. He goes to the house where the church generally meets. He knocks at the door. He shouts to them to let him in. The person who comes to answer is a servant girl called Rhoda. She recognizes Peter's voice and she's so overwhelmed that she rushes back into the house. She forgets to unbolt the door and let him in. All of that's forgotten. She goes back in. "It's Peter. It's Peter. He's there." "You're a stupid woman. You're crazy. You've lost it." And she insists, it is Peter. I recognize his voice. No mistaking it. "Well, maybe it's his spirit. Maybe it's his angel. Maybe it's his ghost. I don't know what it is, but he's in prison for goodness sake." No, it's really him. It really is him. Meanwhile, the battering on the door continues all through this sort of debate that's going on inside. And so in the end, they open the door to him. And, of course, it is Peter. Peter gives a brief explanation and then he's off. After all, once the escape is known and discovered, Herod's soldiers are going to be combing every place that they can think of in town looking for him. So the headline story, that's the headline story, the prison breakout. At a deeper level, it seems to me that this account is about something a bit different than that. It's actually about prayer, it's about faith, it's about the power of God. And it's those things that I really want to explore this morning. And the subtext of what's going on here is something like this. That bad things will happen in this world, but God is at work for good in the midst of it all. He's working through the active responses of his people and especially through their prayers. And I want to break that down just a little bit. First of all, bad things will happen. If you remember a couple of weeks ago when Sophie preached and ended up with the standing ovation at the end. Well, it wasn't quite that, but it was sort of a ripple of applause anyway. But when Sophie preached a couple of weeks ago, she was reminding us about the Christmas story, that it wasn't just cuddly animals and a cozy manger, but it actually includes this very dark account of Herod's massacre, a different Herod, massacre of the babies. And there is tragedy and bloodletting at the heart of the Christmas story. And though the angel delivers Mary and Joseph and Jesus from the slaughter that goes on, there are dozens of families who aren't so lucky. And Matthew sums this up in his gospel when he says this is a fulfillment of Jeremiah's prophecy that there is weeping and wailing. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. It is a situation of real tragedy. And the same applies the same does apply in Acts chapter 12. Because this is a wonderful story of God's deliverance, but it is not uncomplicated. It isn't a story of universal happy endings, and it isn't without great tragedy. For a start, James the Apostle is arrested. I'm pretty sure the church prayed for him just as fervently as they did for Peter, but it doesn't work, and James is executed. That is another of the top leaders of the church gone dead. And then right at the end of this story, Peter goes free, but the soldiers who were detailed to guard him were killed. Now, that's not a great outcome for them. It was, of course, standard Roman practice that you let your prisoner go free, you die in their place. And so, when Herod is inquired what's going on, he has them executed. We don't know whether it was just the four or whether it was all 16, all four sets of four guards. We don't know, but these are guys with wives and children. There's a lot of weeping here as well. This is not a story where every ending is a happy ending. So without making a meal of this morning, let's be very clear about it. Being a Christian does not mean that good things will always happen for us. When we pray, we will not always get everything that we ask for. Not everybody who has prayer for healing will be made well. Not every non-believer who is prayed for will come to faith in Christ. And there will be deeply painful, bad stuff that sometimes happens to us as Christians. When that happens, we're bound to feel a sense of shock, but we should not be surprised. It'll happen. It is the nature of the world that we're in. Christians don't have diplomatic immunity. So bad things will happen. Second thing is that God is at work for good. If we cannot be gung-ho, you know, name it and claim it, we also shouldn't be fatalistic. Romans, Paul says, in all things, God is at work for good for those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. This world is not a God-free zone. Even in the darkest places, even in our darkest nights, God is here. He's at work for our good. There are things that happen here in Acts chapter 12, but also in our lives, that would never happen if God wasn't involved. Probably some of the most inspiring Christian books you've read, and certainly some of the most inspiring Christian books that I've read, come out of situations of horrendous trials. When I was growing up, a very popular book was by a Romanian pastor called Richard Vombrandt, called Tortured for Christ. I remember reading it. It made a real impression. Richard Vombrandt was a pastor, a Christian pastor in Romania in the darkest years of Ceausescu's evil regime. He found himself 14 years in prison. During that time, he was tortured times without number. The whole book is a story of tremendous suffering, but great miracles alongside them. He came to the West sometime after that. He gave evidence to the US Congress, showing them the scars of some of his torture. He did a lot to raise the profile of persecuted Christians in the Eastern European states. I wasn't surprised the other day to discover that Davy Grove knew him personally. Why should I not think that? But you know, it is out of the darkness that God works. Actually, as you look back over some of the rougher times in your own life, if you're like me, sometimes you will not have seen the answers to some of the biggest prayers that you prayed, but you'll know that God gave you tokens of his love in smaller, sometimes quite remarkable ways. God is at work for good. Even in the darkness, God is at work for good. Third thing that I want to say here is that God works through our active responses. For the most part, God in this world does not work around us. He works with us and through us and in partnership with us. Often his response to our prayers is, "I will if you will." He does what only he can do, but he expects us to work with him. And there are examples of that in this chapter. Peter's release from prison is a miracle, but it's a miracle that requires his cooperation. He's not sort of transported out from one place to another. The angel comes, he says, put on your coat, put on your shoes, follow me. There are things that you've got to do. You've got to actually work with me here. When Peter finally finds himself free, wandering the streets, he's got decisions to make. Where am I going to go next? I'm going to go to the church. I'm going to report what happens. And when he's reported back to the church, he doesn't hang around on the basis, well, God's sovereign, he's got everything under control, I just sit here and let him do it. No, he does the sensible thing. He goes into hiding. He goes off to an unknown place. And part of our partnership with God is to do the normal, common sense things. Faith doesn't mean that we're a book. You know, you've got the same principle at the end of Acts, in Acts chapter 27, where Peter, Paul and his companions find themselves in the middle of a shipwreck. And in that desperate situation, Paul gets a word from God to say, everything is going to be all right. Everyone, every member of this boat's manifest is going to be saved. On the strength of that, he doesn't sit down and say, well, that's fine then. I can just twiddle my fingers and God's doing it. No, he goes to everybody. He says, we're going to be all right. So get some food because you need the strength that it gives you. There's normal, sensible, common sense stuff that needs to be done because we're cooperating with what God's doing here. He makes sure that the professional soldiers don't abandon ship, leaving everyone else to their fate. We need their expertise. Trusting God and doing the stuff that we need to do go hand in hand. And if you're trusting God for a job, generally speaking, you should also be going for loads of interviews. If you're trusting God for money, you should be budgeting what you've got sensibly. If you're trusting God for healing, you should be getting medical advice and following it. God works through our active responses. Main thing I want to say this morning is, above all, God works through the prayers of his people. God works through the prayers of his people. And it is prayer that's at the forefront of Peter's release from prison. It's almost as if this is happening in two dimensions. There's a sort of visible dimension where Herod's doing his stuff and the guards are doing their stuff and you've got Peter's situation in prison. And then you've got the invisible other dimension where stuff is going on that nobody sees, but actually there's prayer that is going on. And if you like, in the heavenlies, or however you imagine this, there is something really significant that's happening that is invisible. Today, I think in Britain, we are so deeply affected by our materialist culture that right across the nation, actually, it's not just Woody, it's not just Cardiff, right across our nation, we are so affected by our materialist culture that we neglect prayer. There is, it seems, something deep inside us that says, well, you know, prayer is all very well, but really, it's only the icing on the cake. What really matters is the methods that we use, the money that we've got, the plans we make, the strategies that we've got. The important things are the things that we can see, and it isn't true. But it's there in our culture. You announce a meeting to share food and everybody comes. Isn't it true? You announce a meeting to pray and suddenly there's any number of reasons why folks can't come. We say that we value prayer, but the reality is, far more than we'd like to think, that we really don't. Now, I want to challenge us on this. Because the prayers of the church in Acts chapter 12 are answered. They're answered astonishing. They're answered way beyond what these guys ever imagined. What kind of prayer has that kind of power? I want to point four things this morning that we can draw from the prayer that brought about Peter's release. First of all, in verse 5, it is earnest prayer. You know, these guys prayed as if the outcome of their prayers really mattered to them, because it did. It wasn't 10 minutes added on, tacked on to the end of a meeting. It wasn't a casual mention before mealtimes. This was real earnest prayer. How do you achieve earnest prayer? First of all, it seems to me that we need to create space. And that space might be at the beginning of the day before we'd normally get up for breakfast. It might be at the end of the day when normally we would read television or read a book, watch television or read a book. But there is no praying as if we mean it Unless we make space in our lives to do that, it won't happen on automatic pilot. And it may be even that God's calling you to something a little bit more drastic than that. Fasting from food, perhaps. One of the things that I've found over the years has been really powerful in terms of deepening my prayer life has been to fast, maybe miss a meal regularly each day. Maybe to have a 24-hour fast once or twice. There have been real disaster situations, not for us, but for other people that we've known, that I've just sensed God saying, give 24 hours, prayer and fasting. It may be that it's not fasting, but watching that God's calling you to. A couple of times when I was young, which 40 years ago or so, I was in situations that were so desperate, so critical, that I just knew that I had to keep on praying through the night. And I went through a couple of nights without sleep in order just to do business with God. Sometimes maybe it's something more 21st century that God's calling you to. You know, what difference would it make if you gave up TV and the internet for a week? How much time is liberated by that? How much mental space just to say, okay, God, I'm saying no to that so that I can say yes to you. Sometimes when I've been in the house on my own for a few days, I've pulled the television out to plug out at the wall, just to say at the outset of the time, this is going to be a time, me and God. We need to make space. If we're going to pray earnestly, we need to be prepared to linger. We need to be prepared to pray without an eye on the clock or a deadline to finish. Because if we're in earnest, we're going to be approaching God with an attitude that, Lord, we'll give this as long as it takes. And certainly we will keep on returning. If we're in earnest, we won't pray once and then just forget about it. We will keep coming back until we see the answer come. Jesus tells a story in Luke chapter, I think it's 18, of a woman who suffered injustice and she badgers officialdom time and time and time and again until she gets the answer. She's in a position of powerlessness, except that she just keeps on badgering and she keeps going back and back until she wears out the judge that is holding out on her. Until he's so sick and tired of her at his front door that he says, I'll give you your answer. Jesus suggests that we could do with having that same attitude of never say die, never give up in our prayers. This is earnest prayer. Secondly, it's united prayer. The action in Acts chapter 12 takes place in the middle of the night. I'm guessing that this is probably in the early hours, you know, probably after midnight. The streets are empty, you know, Peter's asleep, all that sort of stuff. Everyone in the church would have had work to get up for early the next morning. And yet we read in verse 12 that many were gathered for prayer at that time of the morning. There is a special power in united prayer. I want to thank those who came to the Alpha prayer meeting last Sunday night. I know it was probably the worst Sunday of the year to expect folks to come out, but on behalf of the team, we really, really appreciate those who did. We would still value prayer, actually, for Alpha. We've probably got a couple of folks doing Alpha with us already, with the possibility of a handful of others who sound interested but uncertain. So there's plenty to pray for here. The other thing about united prayer is that it's not just about numbers, but it's about praying in a unity of heart and spirit. And in Matthew chapter 18, Jesus says to his disciples, again, I tell you that if two of you on earth agree about anything you ask for, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. For where two or three come together in my name, there I am in the midst of them. When we opened our house for prayer in Sheffield back in our first pastorate, we were in a situation which was really quite a difficult one. And a group of people came, and there was just such a sense of unity and that you could, you knew that there was power in it. It was, it marked the point where a dead church came alive, where we saw God moving for the first time in that place. In any group of people, there will always be times when we're a little bit at sixes and sevens. As a church, we've got a wonderful eldership team. I sometimes make jokes about them, but they are actually a fine group of dedicated people. We're privileged to have them, and I can say this because none of them are here this morning. But there are occasions when we haven't seen eye to eye, and we've come for a prayer evening together, and we've sat down, and we've not resolved the stuff. And nothing has happened. It's been absolutely dead. And it's only when we've said, okay, we need to sort stuff, person to person, that actually the Spirit has been released. It is important that we come with a harmony, with a unity of heart and mind. Okay, so that's the second thing, united prayer. Third thing about this is that it's persevering prayer that makes a difference. You may be wondering where I get this from in Acts chapter 12, so let me tell you why I'm suggesting this. The first action that takes place here is the arrest of James, one of the 12 apostles. Now, it doesn't say so, so I can't prove this, but I'm pretty certain that the whole church would have joined in prayer for James. After all, he's one of the top leaders of the church. His life is in danger. But there is no miracle for James. He's executed. He is dead, stone dead. He's gone. He's no longer there. Now, what happens when we don't get the answer to prayer that we're looking for? The temptation is that we give up and we get disappointed and disillusioned. And it is immensely to these guys' credit that they didn't give up. They don't give up. They must have been disappointed. But they're not about to throw in the towel. They keep on praying. They keep on going to God with their issues, even in the midst of huge heartache. I think that's relevant to us because the chances are that we will face times like that when we don't get the answers to prayer that we're looking for. When somebody that we love very much dies, they've been prayed for, but they die. When a job that is important to us goes pear-shaped, when our health goes down the tubes and we're in pain and we don't get healing, we might have had prayer for healing, but it doesn't actually come. We might face times when our family seems to implode. You can fill in the blanks because it'll be different for each of us, but big disappointments can come in many shapes and sizes. And it is a real challenge, isn't it? To keep going after that, but there's real power when we do so, when we keep faith with God in prayer, even through our tears, and we say to God, I'm not giving up on this. Fourthly, this is believing prayer. Scripture is clear that one of the keys to effective prayer is faith. In Matthew chapter 17 and verse 20, Jesus said, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, tiny seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Nothing will be impossible to you. Faith like a mustard seed. Well, I'm glad that Jesus makes that point about faith the size of a mustard seed, because often my faith is not outstandingly strong. I don't know about yours. But often my faith isn't wonderful. And it is interesting to see both the reality of faith and the limitations of faith in Acts chapter 12. Certainly there is real faith amongst these guys. There's faith enough to pray. There's faith enough to devote time and effort to seeking God's intervention. There is faith enough in Peter to follow the angel out of the prison. But you know, Peter only actually believes the miracle is taking place when it's all over. He doesn't immediately see the light and say, God save me! It's only when he's out in the street that he says, actually, God's done something here. Feeling the cold breeze in his face, standing in the street on his own. God's done something. And the guys at the prayer meeting, what about them? They're praying that Peter will be released from prison. And when Rhoda goes back and tells them that their prayers have been answered, they say that she's bonkers. She's lost her mind. She's crazy. Now, that in truth, fairly limited faith, isn't it? It isn't the kind of faith that you think, oh, that's a real example. I must follow that. And that's encouraging. Well, it's encouraging to me because what it tells me is that God can work in us even when our faith struggles. Even when we're in two minds between expectation and disbelief, even when we know that our faith is not in the place where it needs to be, should be, ought to be, we can still come to God honestly with the level of faith that we've got, and he will honour that. So let's bring all of these things down to earth. Earnestness. Is there an issue or a person that God has impressed on you to pray for? If so, let me ask the question, how is he asking you to make space for significant prayer? Where in your life is he inviting you to make time, perhaps shift some clutter out of the way, in order that you can take time with him? There might be a challenge to earnestness for some of us. There may be a challenge to unity. We've got an immediate application for this. I don't need to find applications because on Wednesday night, we had the opportunity to come as a united church for prayer and to seek God for the future. I just want to say, make it a priority. Be there. Come ready to do business with God. Perseverance. It may be that some of us are in a place of disappointment or weariness with God. It happens. Maybe some of you are at that place right now. And perhaps this is the moment when you need to take a deep breath, get a second wind, and decide, God, I am not actually going to give up on this. God, I'm going to keep faith with you. And maybe it would be good this morning just to get someone to pray fresh strength and fresh spiritual energy into you as you take that stand. And belief. Maybe you're struggling between faith and doubts. Well, don't sit on the doubts, don't deny them, don't sweep them under the carpet. There's no benefit operating in denial and pretending that we're in a better place of faith than we really are. But take it to the Lord. Lay it down before him. Lay down before him your questions, your uncertainty. Ask him to renew your trust in him. And let's together, because prayer is key, it's a big, big thing. Let's together move up a gear in our prayer life as God's people and be prepared to be surprised at what God will do.